If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Go ahead, Tommy. I thought you were starting.
It was unclear what the starting procedure was. But in today's podcast, we've got a really fun topic because we have spent a week with the most controversial car on the market.
The what's that little electric Fiat that is going to be sold?
The Topolino.
The Topolino. Is that what we're going to be discussing? A Topolino, Tommy?
No, we're not talking Topolino. We are talking about a different Fiat, though, because we spent the week with the Dodge Charger, and specifically the new six-pack Dodge Charger, the gasoline Charger. But we've also spent a week with the new Jeep Cherokee, which is another really, really, really popular car.
You drove the Telluride?
Yep. New Telluride is in the house.
I drove the Q3.
Yeah, you drove the Q3. So
we even spent time behind the wheel of the Pacifica, believe it or not.
Yeah, a lot going on here at the TFL offices. So.
And then we bought a new car.
What did we buy? Oh, that's next week's podcast.
Well, we can tease it.
We'll talk about it, yeah. So we also bought a Land Cruiser. Yeah. But next week, we're going to do a full little off-road podcast on that car.
And Tommy, we might even get into Formula One because there's controversy. Well, there's always controversy at Formula One, but this year it's very controversial because they've switched to, oh my God, environmentally friendly electricity. And we can't have that, can we, in Formula One? Because there's overtaking, but there's no more passing. There's a distinction, you know, between overtaking and passing. I'll tell you about that as well. So we've got all that coming up, but let's start with the new Charger, which is very confusing. Let's start with that. So once upon a time, at least in the last model year, you could always tell the difference between a Charger and a Challenger because a Challenger had two L's, which meant that it had two doors. And then the Charger didn't have two L's in the name. That was the two-door.
No.
That was a four-door. Sorry. That's the other way around. This is what I mean. It's very confusing. Don't roll your eyes. It's very impolite.
Well, you said it was super easy in the old one.
I said it was very confusing. I'm not rolling my eyes at you. It was very confusing. And then the previous generation was also, you couldn't tell which one was a two-door and this four-door. But the new one, they retired the Challenger, which was a two-door, and they built a four-door. First a two-door and then a four-door Charger now. So there's a two-door and a four-door. So I am completely confused whether the Charger or Challenger is two or four doors. But right now, the Charger is either two-door or if you want to spend an additional $2,000, it's four-door.
How did you manage to take such a simple thing?
Because it's freaking confusing.
It's always been super simple, okay?
It's never been super simple. It's been the exact opposite of super simple.
In the 1960s and 70s, yes, right?
Okay, go for it.
The Charger and the Challenger were both two doors. Mm. They were variants on different bodies, okay. Right? One was an E body, I think the other one was a B body. Then when it was resurrected in the early 2000s, the Charger became a four-door sedan.
Right.
And then alongside the four-door sedan was the two-door Challenger. Okay.
So that's not confusing.
No, it makes perfect sense. I mean, it was confusing at first, but I think people have become used to Charger 4-door, Challenger 2-door.
And now?
And now the Charger has taken place of both of them. So now you should be happy because it's simplified.
I'm not happy because it's very confusing.
So the Charger now is available in both 2- and 4-door configuration, which means that essentially you can get the same car, the same look, and the same design, just in different flavors, right? Do you want the family hauling one, or do you want the more single-minded oriented 2-door, less practical one? But what's unique about this is in the old Charger and Challenger, they looked very different, right? And they were also different sizes. But now the new Charger 2- and 4-door is the same length. They're both 206 inches. It's got the same roof line. It's got the same interior volume.
So there's three models, basically $5,000 apart.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also confusing because there's like four names for three models. Right, there's a six pack, which signifies that it's got a straight six, mm-hmm. which is in the RT and in the Scat Pack.
Uh-huh.
So you got a six pack RT, and you got a six pack Scat Pack, and then you got the Daytona, which is the electric one. And basically, starting out, give or take, okay, because this changes, but give or take, the three models are $5,000 apart. So the RT, let's say, starts at about $50,000. Which you won't find because you're going to have to get all the accessories and blah, blah, blah. And then the Scat Pack goes to 55, and then the Daytona goes to 60, which is the all EV one.
Starting.
Yeah. But in real life, that's probably more like $5,000 or $10,000 more.
Yeah.
And that's also confusing. So you've got one model with four names.
Listen, Dad, this car's got a lot of problems. But the naming structure, I think, is not one of the problems.
One model with four names.
No, it's RT, Scat Pack, Daytona. That's all you need
six
to know.
Six pack. What about
the six pack is just like saying Hemi. It's the same thing, right? Instead of saying Hemi, you say six pack. That's just the engine, yeah. Right? It's just the engine name.
Yeah.
It's like saying Coyote.
And in the previous one, they were all Hemis.
No.
For the most part, except for
the Pentastar.
Yeah.
I think that it's you just got to get your head in the divorced dad rock phase, right?
Oh God.
That's the problem. You got to embrace Creed. Nickelback, Puddle of Mud. The naming structure makes sense to these people. You got RT, Scat Pack. They're both six packs.
Yeah, even that sounds confusing.
The pack is confusing, and then the Daytona is the electric one. But let's talk about why this car is so controversial. So this car launched as the Daytona, came out first as the electric one.
Yeah, which was like what Cole came up with this. Thank you, Cole. It was like selling fish hooks to fish.
Yeah.
Yeah. No muscle car guy or gal wanted an electric muscle car.
But
no matter how much horsepower.
What I think happened is they were like 5 years too late to the party. Because if they had introduced the electric one, let's say in 2017 or 2018.
Yeah, Stellantis has incredibly bad timing right now.
I do think that potentially there would have been some interest in it because that's when we saw vehicles like the Tesla Model S Plaid, right? Got everybody really excited. The Lucid Air came out, and then you had the Sapphire, which got everybody excited. But by the time Stellantis finally got their butts in gear and came out with the electric Charger, people were over the electric thing and they were back to wanting gas, right? So they launched the Daytona first, I think, to be kind of the halo product.
And actually, if you're watching this, you'll see that the Daytona has this really cool wing on the front.
The Delta wing, yeah.
Yeah, which is missing from the RT and the Scat Pack.
Yeah. So they launched the electric one first, and that was supposed to be their halo product. It was incredibly mistimed, and also, to your and Cole's point, it was also the wrong product for the wrong audience, right? When you think about the typical Charger buyer, it's someone who values V8, sound, and thinking that traction control is a government conspiracy, and you're just not going to sell them one of those left-wing electric cars, right? Like, that's fundamentally the problem with it. So they really rushed hard to get the gasoline versions back into production. The challenge was when this car debuted, right? That was like right after the push to kill the V8s, right? 2023 into 2023, Stellantis came out and said, look, we're done with the V8s. We're moving to electrification. We're going to smaller displacement.
Here's what worries me, Tommy. I've been doing this 17 years, and in 17 years, this has always held true. You only have one chance to make a first impression. And the first impression they made with the electric Daytona was that it was A, electric, and B, that it was expensive, and
sure.
C, that it was unwanted. And now that they've come out with the Hurricane-powered, which is actually a really good car. I mean, think about this. If you want a traditional American muscle car, there aren't a lot of choices out there. There just aren't. And so now you have this straight six Very powerful. I want to say in the RT, it's what, 450 horse?
420.
420, and how much is the Scat Pack?
550.
Which is a lot of power.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of power. So you have this curvy, right? I'm doing the Coke bottle shape with my hands if you're listening to this. Vehicle that is styled by one of the most talented stylists out there, Ralph Giles, and his team. And the car is absolutely gorgeous. It's classic. It's big. It's got a lot of road presence. It makes a good sound right now. I'm, you know, a straight six, obviously a lot of the muscle car people like the roar of a V8, but a straight six has its own magic to it as well. But the problem is, the people who should typically like this car aren't going to give it a second chance because it came out as electric, and I feel and I fear that it spoiled the lineup for the typical Dodge fan. That's my biggest worry.
Well, and like you started your argument by saying classic American muscle car. This is not a classic American muscle car.
Well, this is, we've had this discussion. You think it's more of a German, like, because it's got a, it looks like it's got a trunk, but really the back is a hatchback.
It's a liftback. I mean.
So like it's more of like an A7.
So it's a fundamental mindset shift, right, in what a Charger is. So if you want to go, be careful with your bracelet right in front of the mic there. We don't want to blow up the sound. If you look at like the typical American muscle car, the V8 is the core of that experience. Right, that is what a muscle car is a big V8 in a small family platform. That's what the original GTO was. It was a Le Mans with a V8, right? That's what all of that huge 1960s era was. You took essentially a family car, and then you put a large displacement 8-cylinder engine in it. This is not that. You still have the family car shape, but instead of large displacement, it's a relatively, for American standards, normal displacement engine with a couple of turbos and all-wheel drive and a focus on handling. So this is a total mindset shift. And the reality is, like it's a, like you mentioned earlier, it's actually a really good car to drive, and it feels so German to me. It really does feel like a budget RS7 or maybe a BMW Grand Coupe because the dynamics are excellent. Right, especially you get the RT, the one we have on test right now, has a sport package. So you get the sport suspension, 275 with tires. You get the high back bucket seats. This car handles excellent.
Look how happy Case is.
He's having a good time.
And if there's anybody who loves classic American muscle, it's Case.
Yes, but once again, this is not a classic American muscle experience. This is a German experience.
I disagree. I'm not going to go there. I get what you're saying.
I mean, it's refined. It sounds like a BMW. It handles a little bit like a heavy BMW.
Yeah, but this would never fly. If you took this car to Europe, the Europeans wouldn't look at it as a classic German muscle
car.
No,
but
they would say this is as American as it gets. I disagree.
They wouldn't say it's American as it gets because it has eight cylinders.
I get that the ingredients are those of a potentially German car, but I disagree.
It's all-wheel drive.
I think this is as American as it gets.
It's not.
Well, that's a difference of opinion, Tommy. But you look at the interior, you look at the look at that stance. Look at the way the thing, you know, is squinty-eyed. It's like it's almost like Clint Eastwood saying, "I forgot how many bullets did I shoot." Right. That is as American as a muscle car gets. Yes, it's not a traditional Hemi, and they may put a Hemi in still.
They will put a Hemi in, right?
Yeah.
So when that happens, I will be 100% with you. But as the car sits now, as an inline 6-cylinder twin turbo all wheel drive liftback, that's not fundamentally what we would consider a muscle car. Formula.
Yeah, but that also changes over time.
Not really. A muscle car is a muscle car.
It does change. Of course it changes because generations change.
I mean, the Mustangs...
And their definitions of muscle car also changes.
But I disagree, Dad, because the Mustang has been the same formula since...
You always disagree with me, so hear me out. You'll never agree with me.
Hear me out. Has the Mustang formula changed since 1965?
Yes, it has changed.
How?
Well...
Is it still rear-wheel drive?
Well, first and foremost, the original Mustang was a secretary's car. And I know that's stereotypical and probably sexist, but back then that's what they called it. So I'm going with it. So it was a 6-cylinder, and it wasn't an 8-cylinder, and it eventually turned into that.
But it launched with an 8. For the record, though, it came out as an 8-cylinder.
But it started out as an affordable.
Yes. But that formula is still the same. It's still an affordable way to get a V8, right? I mean, the Mustang has always been a rear-wheel drive.
I don't want to argue. It's getting. We're starting to bicker, and it's
boring. But my point, Dad, is that this is not a Charger experience, right?
I think it is a Charger experience. I completely disagree. I think it's as American and quintessentially
twin turbo inline six.
Yeah, yes, that's fine. It is, and yes, people are going to have a hard time with the twin turbo straight six, But I like straight sixes. I just think it's a different flavor of muscle. So it's not necessarily the traditional flavor, but that doesn't mean that muscle can't evolve over time. I think if they do put a V8 into it, then it'll be more your definition. But I like practical muscle. I like the fact that you can do that lift back and throw your bike back there.
Sure.
I think that's one of the great things about it. And I think if you look at traditional American sedans, just look at the shape. A four-door big sedan.
It's there not a sedan, though.
But you see what I'm saying? It's a four-door. Yeah. It doesn't matter, right? It doesn't really matter whether it's a lift back or whether it's a trunk. Subaru made that mistake, and they got rid of the lift back, and everybody in the WRX and the STI is like, why'd you get rid of the lift back? It was so much more practical. We loved it. And they got hung up on
the definition
of a sedan being either, you know, a trunk or – so I don't care about that. I care about the overall shape. I think if you look at it, to me, it says traditional American sedan, especially in the four-door. And I think those are few and far between. And if muscle buyers want that, this is the car for them. Yes, it doesn't have the V8. But then again, the Hemi is an old engine. And let's face it, it's a very great marketing term. I get the Hemi marketing. People love themselves a Hemi, but the thing isn't nearly as powerful, and it's crazy thirsty. So, yeah, you're going to pay a lot for that Hemi sound. And the one they're bringing back, Tommy, isn't like a new version of it. It's the old one that they put on the shelf because it was thirsty, it wasn't very powerful, and reliability was so-so. And that's what you're putting back into it. And I believe in giving people what they want. If that's what you guys want, you're going to get it. But don't expect 550 horsepower out of the old Hemi.
Oh, it'll be 700 because they're going to put the Hellcat engine in it.
Yeah, but I'm saying before then.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to put the 5.7 back in it.
I think they're just going to go
right to the Hellcat. Huh? Yeah. So I love the car. I'm not saying I don't love the car. I think the car is actually excellent. I just think that it's not what people expect it to be, and that's why it's struggling.
I think it's because they came out with the electric one, and people.
Oh, for
people,
sure,
people
that's
aren't
definitely
gonna give
it
a second chance, unfortunately.
But if you do give it a second chance, I love it because I find it fundamentally to be a very different experience than what you'd come to expect out of the old one. I actually find that even though it's 4,800 pounds and is longer than an Explorer, with modern suspension and tire technology, you're able to really mask a lot of that weight, right? So the car handles surprisingly well, which is something that you could never really say about the old one. I know that the wide bodies were a little bit better, but I find that this car is really dynamic and fun to drive on a twisty road. I like the power delivery. It feels very much like a BMW N54 in how it delivers powers and the sound it makes. So I really do think the experience is excellent. But to your point, I don't think that people are going to give it a second chance.
So I also think it's a fool's errand to try to out BMW. I think you gotta stick with your core value, which is what you do best, and that is obviously American big ass sedan muscle car. But there are some issues that I have with it. Nothing to do with the ones you have. My issues are that once again, there's this trend among designers, and I don't know if this is you, Rolf, or if it's on the other team. As part of this, that are just infuriating and stupid, and you know, it's like guys that are too clever by half, adding these stupid things that nobody wants, but yet all designers love. And I'll give you an example of that: electronic door handles. Why? Why do we have to have electronic door handles on this?
Yeah, the door handles are stupid,
yeah.
For sure.
And there's a little manual one
right
below it,
yeah.
And yet you have to. And in fact, I find the doors really infuriating because the placement of those buttons is kind of too far back. And so I'm always trying to find out where that little button is. Also, the start-stop button. Most start-stop buttons are in front, so I'm always pushing forward. And
sure.
Yet they put it down the center here.
But that's kind of cool.
Kind of where Saab had their, you know, the key.
Yeah, it's kind of funky,
so
though.
So every time I sit in the car, I'm like, oh, no, it's over here.
But I think that's a little bit like a jet fighter. I mean, you have that pistol grip shifter, right? So that they kind of move that experience down to the center console.
And that's my other gripe with the car. I want that pistol grip shifter not to be plastic, but to be metal.
For sure. That does feel cheap.
It feels very cheap, and it feels like – and then the one that drives me absolutely nutty – there's a bit of trim that goes along the side of the car that's French stitch. So you've got this French stitching, there's this bit of trim, and it's supposed to line up exactly with the trim that's on top of the dashboard. But the two don't line up, and not just by a little bit. I mean, they don't line up by like a half an inch.
It's really bad.
And it just once you see it, if you have OCD like I do, then you just can't unsee it. And every time you get in the car, you're just focusing on these two little bits of trim with the French stitching that doesn't line up. And you're like, come on, guys, you're better than this.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So those are my biggest gripes. But overall, I really love the car. I enjoy the look of it. I enjoy the sound of it. It makes me happy when I drive it. And I actually like the RT better than the Scat Pack because I think the 420 horsepower is plenty. It's also all-wheel drive, so it's good in the snow. I just went to Vermont and drove it in the snow. It's amazing. If you put snow tires on the thing, it'll be completely unstoppable. And my only issue with it is I think the ones I've seen are with you know the options are just a little too expensive.
So for sure.
I think the one that we have right now, the RT 65,000, and that's 15,000 over the average new car price, and that just seems very very steep for most people.
Yeah, I think that the especially because like the thing with the Charger is it's always been cheap speed mm-hmm. and Challenger especially, right? And this is no longer cheap speed. Like I said, I do really think it's kind of like a budget RS7, but the reality is it's also gaining up in price. So if you guys want to comment live, and we do have some commenters live, head on over to patreon.com/TFLcar. Big thank you to everyone that supports the studio. And let's go to the chat because we've created some controversy. So Trey Smith in the live chat says, I normally always side with Tommy, but on the muscle car argument, I can see how it may be evolving. That's your point. People were up in arms over the Mustang removing the solid axle, saying it isn't a muscle car if it becomes independent, but then everyone accepted it. And then Trey says, that said, I don't consider a 1,000-horsepower Tesla a muscle car.
True that.
So other comments. Jeremiah wonders, is Dodge sponsoring Roman?
Well, Jeremiah, you probably posted that comment before I went through my long list of grievances. So does that answer your question?
And then Chris brings up an interesting point. He says, my problem with the Hurricane versus Hemi is the perceived fuel savings of the Hurricane. I drove both in the Wagoneer, and the MPG was worse with the Hurricane engine.
Yeah.
That is a realistic problem. That's the EcoBoost problem, right? It's the Eco and the Boost.
Yeah, you get one or the other. Yeah. And by the way, tomorrow or today, depending on when you're watching this, we're putting out a video where Andre and I spent the day driving to the branch and back in regular mode versus eco mode. Mm. And I'm not going to give it away. Usually I would give it away, but you really should watch that video because, and that's it here, alltfl.com. It's on my shirt. Because that the results of that were really surprising. And the reason we, of course, did that was because fuel prices have skyrocketed overnight, it seems like. And so we wanted to see if you want to save some fuel, if it's worth hitting that eco button if you have it in your vehicle. Like I said, the results were completely unexpected and blew my mind because it didn't do what I thought it would do, which is kind of a hint as to what happened. And this is also something that I think we need to get at, and that is Stellantis has just incredibly bad timing, at least in my mind. So like you said, you know, they missed the train when it came to electric cars. It's too late and too expensive. And now that they're putting Hemis in everything and Hellcatting everything, all of a sudden gas has just gone, I don't know what it is in most states, but here if you're putting premium fuel in, it's $5 a gallon basically for premium.
Sure.
Or close to it. And I think if you're in California, that number is going to be a lot higher. And at some point, if prices of fuel don't go down, this Iran conflict war, whatever you want to call it, just seems to be getting worse. It doesn't look like this is going to get sorted anytime soon. And all the folks who are clamoring for Hemis and Hellcats, are they still going to be willing to spend, let's call it $80,000?
I think the Hellcat people will.
You think so? Even if fuel prices are now, know.
Have you ever met someone who drives a Hellcat?
So I hear that, Tommy. I hear that. And it's one of those things that, like, you kind of pound your chest and you're like, yeah, Hellcat everything. And then when you go to the dealership and you look at the reality of how much that's going to cost and how much fuel you're going to put in it, people's buying habits do shift, and they do shift rather quickly.
I don't think that the Hellcat buyer is looking at long-term costs. I think that they're going in and
I'm
they're...
I'm
going
to say the Hellcat buyer's wife is certainly looking at long-term costs.
I don't think the typical...
Or girlfriend or partner.
I don't think that's the case either, unfortunately. The Hellcat dad is notorious for being sold to people with 400 credit scores for 84-month loans. This is not someone that really is focused on the geopolitical situation about gas prices. So I think that if it was any other product, I would agree. But these are people that want to go fast at any cost and they want to sound cool. So I think that,
So we haven't – here's what ends up happening. Right now we're like 3 weeks into this war and we really haven't seen a lot of focus – on fuel prices.
I've seen a ton of focus.
It's kind of in the background.
It's what everyone's talking about.
People are no, not in the media. I can go to my news feed and it's all war related, but there's not a lot of stories about the price of fuel. There are those stories about like other countries because we were lucky enough that we at least at this point in history, we have enough fuel that we don't have to rely on Middle East fuel.
Okay.
But the rest of the world does, unfortunately. Yeah, but is that the...
First story.
Yeah, but look, I'll go to my...
And then they've got a constant ticker about the fuel prices.
So this is Apple News, top stories. U.S. deploy thousands of additional troops.
Yeah, but that's based on what you read. Yeah. It tailors to what you read,
Today. I just did the headlines today.
Well, every news site I've seen has been really...
Anyway, I don't think there's been this...
Okay.
There has been this... Because it will all of a sudden explode, and then you're going to have man on the streets. Well, what do you think of filling up your car? And when it becomes that kind of overwhelming news cycle where the fuel costs become... Because I think right now people are like, this is going to be a temporary thing. It's going to we're waiting for the price to come down. But if this turns into a long... And I feel like it's becoming a quagmire because apparently everything we ever do in the Middle East is always a quagmire. Then I think people's buying decisions are going to change. And the other thing I'm going to say about this is there was a lot of hand-wringing in the media not that long about the fact that we have one of these cars, that all these EVs are coming off lease. The number is 300,000.
Wow.
EVs are coming off lease this year. And, mm-hmm. and everybody's like, oh my God, what's going to happen? These things are not going to be able to get sold. And you're already seeing the effect of this war on prices of Teslas because right now Tesla prices, used car prices, are up between 3 and 5%.
Sure, makes sense.
And that has not happened with the Leafs of the world or the Ioniq 5s, but that is also going to happen. And I'm guessing, and this is 17 years of experience doing this, that at some point, if fuel prices stay high, all those 300,000 EVs are going to get gobbled up. And all of a sudden, Stellantis is hellcatting everything, getting rid of all of their 4xEs, and people are going to start looking for more fuel-efficient vehicles, and they're not going to be able to offer them to them because they killed everything. Well, Honda did the same thing.
They still have the EV charger. There you go.
$70,000.
Yeah. Well, that's what a 4xE was. They were like 60.
No, they were giving those away for a while. You could buy those with gum wrapper.
Yeah, but that was because of tax incentives.
Yes, I'm saying. Right?
But that's gone away too now.
But that also then sets the used price of those.
They're so cheap. 4xEs are not going up. And you know why 4xEs don't go up?
Because
they're a reliability nightmare.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I think that I agree with you that like it's probably a good time to buy an EV, but that's not going to sway a Hellcat buyer.
I don't know. We'll see.
I don't think Hellcat buyers care about gas prices.
Time will tell. All I'm seeing and kind of putting my finger up in the air is that everybody's kind of like making fun of the fact that all these stupid companies are now writing off. It's been like $100 billion, and that they invested EVs at the wrong time, and people don't want them. But there's two factors that they usually fail to mention. One is oil prices. Somehow they forget about that. And two is the fact that the rest of the world is going EVs, and these companies are global and not local. So yeah, in America, the EV may have crested and hit the rocks of reality, but the rest of the world is still gung-ho for EVs. And I think if what's happening in Canada and what's happening in South and Central America, and that is that the cheap Chinese EVs are already there mm-hmm. or coming, you're going to see one of the Chinese companies buy, let's say, one of the Stellantis brands, because let's face it, Chrysler sells one car right now, and that's the minivan, and it's hard to keep a brand alive in one car. Speaking of that, we did drive the Pacifica.
Yeah, and we also drove the Jeep Cherokee.
Yeah, so let's talk about the
Pacifica. Let's talk about the Cherokee.
Let's talk about just quickly about the Pacifica. I actually like it a lot. I think the Pacifica is such a useful vehicle.
It's Stellantis Day here, Dad.
Yeah, but no, but because it still has real buttons.
Yeah,
and all that stuff I talked about, in the Daytona and the Scat Pack and the RT doesn't come into play here. You've got regular door handles. You've got real buttons for HVAC. No haptic controls. It's just refreshing to get in a car and like know how to start it and know how to change the temperature control without having to take your eyes off the road. Didn't you like it?
Yeah, it's great.
You don't like the
minivans
are so useful, dude.
I love vans. I mean, if you want to watch the video, I go about how much I like minivans, and it's great. Yeah. I just don't think people listen to podcasts for minivan news.
Okay, you think we're boring. I'm right. We'll move on to the Cherokee, which
that's the unfortunate reality of the situation.
Which we just took off-road and didn't do so well. I think we can use the word seriously struggled.
Yeah, if you go to TFL Off-Road, Cole, you can see the video we just put up. So the Cherokee is back, and this is a vehicle that has a massive fan following, right? The XJ Cherokee, the one from the late 80s and the 90s through 2001, that is probably one of the most beloved 4x4s of all time. So whenever the Cherokee name is put on a new vehicle, I think there's fundamentally quite a bit of interest. Now, the previous gen Cherokee was pretty controversial because it had that wild styling that Mark Allen penned that looked kind of weird in 2014, but actually I think aged pretty well because everyone went to that stacked headlight design.
Yeah, they put the headlights below the turn signals.
And what the old Cherokee had was a shocking amount of off-road capability, because what I think Jeep realized is if you're going to compete against RAV4, CR-V, Tucson Sport, you have to bring something to the table that really makes it stand out. So the Trailhawk really was the most capable crossover maybe to ever exist. It had an actual rear locker, an actual low range, recovery point skid plates. But the new Cherokee's gone in a different direction. So instead of kind of making it Jeep-y, they've made it very fuel efficient. So this is a standard hybrid now.
Which is good, because finally Stellantis has something that's
there
fuel efficient.
There you go, fuel efficient.
And if you're watching this video, you'll see that we couldn't even get it up to the Y between Truth and Dare. We use a hill, test hill, where we test these, let's call them midsize crossovers, mild off-roaders, which the Jeep shouldn't be in my mind. It should be a serious off-roader. But there's a Y where we have Truth and Dare, and we couldn't even get to that Y intersection in the new Cherokee before it started to struggle.
Yeah, and then it turtled itself. It turtle-moded. Yeah. So that
which
means...
Which is what? It overheated.
Yeah, this is... Well, something got hot.
Something
exactly
got
right.
Hot, yeah.
Yeah, this is a big problem. So the Cherokee, the fuel economy is impressive. I think it's 37 combined, 39 city, 35 highway, something like that. 210 horsepower, 230 pound-feet of torque. It's only available in a hybrid, and there's no Trailhawk version currently, right? They're only the standard models. This one we had was a limited. But the problem is, if you're going up against CR-V or RAV4, you got to have something truly outstanding, right, that was going to sway a buyer out of those products. And I'm not sure that Jeep has done that, because the Jeep is the adventure brand, right? That's the adventure nameplate. So if you're going to build a Jeep, you have to bake in a little bit of off-road DNA, and they haven't really done that in this new one.
Yeah, it's a head-scratcher, Tommy. I don't understand why Jeep wouldn't even lead with a Trailhawk, let's say, because to me, the Jeep brand's strongest strength, just like Land Rover / Range Rover, is that they have this heritage of off-roadiness. And yet here we have a vehicle that if you put it up against a Toyota RAV4 Woodster, I know it's called Woodland, or a Subaru Forester, it's going to struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got the 7-slotted grille, they've got the Jeep name on it. Why wouldn't you like lean into, double down on your DNA, which is what the Wrangler brings? And I know that in the past, a lot of the more affordable Jeeps, I'm talking about the Renegade, the Compass, the Cherokee, what's the other one? Liberty, right? They have not been the most off-roady, but some of them...
Liberty was good.
Yeah, some of them have had off-road cred, and this one really does not. And you can take a look at it when you see it. The tires are wrong. The ground clearance isn't right. There's only one real off-road
mode,
which is, I think, mud.
And sand.
And sand. And all that stuff that makes the Jeep so attractive and so adventure-y and so... I think friendly toward today's lifestyle-oriented buyer is missing from this thing, and I just don't understand what happened. The only thing I can think of is that this was when Stellantis was under, what was that guy's name, the previous CEO?
Filosa,
yeah. And it was very, like, European-centered, and they just misunderstood and completely, like miscalculated what American buyers want. You want to talk about some of the comments?
Yeah, we will in a sec, but that was kind of what happened with the Charger, right? I feel like under Stellantis, it's so driven by the execs in Europe that don't, until now, I think that maybe some of the changes have been a good thing. But for the most part, in the past, have been so European-focused that they don't understand the U.S. market. They don't understand the U.S. obsession with V8s. They don't understand the need to put huge tires on things, right? But that's fundamental to what makes a muscle car, and a Jeep a Jeep. And without those things, you might as well just go buy the CR-V, right? You might as well just go buy the Mustang in the case of the Charger, right? So it's a really tricky thing for these Europeans to understand. And I'm hoping, I mean, Cole and Case went on the launch of this, and they didn't confirm that they're coming out with a Trailhawk, but it was certainly suggested that will happen. The issue is, I don't know how you turn that powertrain into something that's going to be good off-road, because it's fundamentally a 1.6 turbo and an eCVT, right? And the issue, well, sorry, one last thing. The big issue we found off-road, it wasn't even the traction or even the ground clearance. We didn't really run out of either of those. It just didn't have the low-end torque delivery. Like, you pointed up a hill full throttle, and the thing would just kind of sit there and... Right? So how do you fix that without a fundamental re-engineer of the car?
Well, it didn't have a lot of things, Tommy. I mean, it didn't have the right tires. It didn't have the suspension travel.
Sure.
It didn't have the recovery hooks. It didn't have all the stuff. It didn't have the real things that make it off-road worthy, or the kind of the fake pseudo things that, you know, a lot of automakers, even like Honda on their Trail Sport, and Honda's becoming serious actually about off-roading. But let's talk about, you know, these vehicles that look off-roady but necessarily aren't off-roady. This thing has neither of those. Why wouldn't you even make it look off-road? Anyway,
sure.
The thing I like about it is it's got an enormous back seat.
Yeah, huge.
And a huge trunk area. So if you're looking for one that is roomy and is fuel efficient, then I think that is certainly some place that you might want to take a look. I don't want to take a dump on this thing.
No. There are some good aspects
because
of it.
You know, a lot of people live in New York and they'll never take the thing off-road in Chicago.
For sure.
So we're very kind of Colorado mountain-centric, so I don't want to be that. But if you're looking for something with just a boat ton of room and really good fuel economy, we're looking at, like, you know, you're getting up to close to 40 mpg.
Yeah.
Then this might be a vehicle that you should take a look at. Let's talk about the comments. Cole, can you put the comments back up for a sec? I know you're showing the interior of the vehicle.
Yeah,
right now.
And you know, you were talking about timing, but Elliot Tucker Dixon says, on the fuel part, my husband is having freak out. We paid $527 Canadian on one tank. In the US will be $320 for his tank. That must be a massive tank, $320. We'll be driving from here to Nova Scotia to BC. We can afford it, yes, but many can't. Mopar was traditionally for low FICOs. If you remember 2009, many did change. Look at the 70s embargo, which I think fuel will be going towards. And if you're talking about gas prices, that Stellantis did nail that with his Jeep, right? So we're complaining about his capability, but the stuff that makes something good off-road, like solid axles, like a low-range transfer case, like body-on-frame construction, right? These are fundamentally very heavy, inefficient things. And if people are moving toward fuel economy or looking for it, maybe the Cherokee is the right choice at the right time.
Well, that's the one they have. So, you know, go to the dance with the one you have. I mean, they're stuck with it now. So
I did do a slip test on it, and that video hasn't gone up. But what I will say happened in our roller test is in the standard mode, it did something funny I've never seen, where I would like push down the pedal, and the engine just like held 5,000 RPM. It was like, but the wheels didn't really turn. But then I put it in the off-road mode, and it actually did a really good job of distributing torque. So if you're not crawling, if you're just looking to get through snow, I have a good feeling that all-wheel drive system will probably be pretty decent. I just wish that and it is a drive shaft. It's not an all-wheel drive like Toyota does. I just wish that they'd pushed it a little bit more toward what that Jeep brand represents. Because realistically, this could be a Chrysler. And maybe it should have been a Chrysler.
Maybe it should have been a Chrysler, yeah.
And I think people would have loved it more, right? Because as a Chrysler, there's not that pretense that it has to be good in the dirt. It can just be comfortable and fuel efficient, and it is.
All right, let's keep going. You recently went on the launch of the Telluride, and we have the Palisade here at our office. So those are two of the best-selling Kias and Hyundais right now. And they're very popular vehicles. So tell me about the new Telluride, and I'll tell you kind of what I feel about the Palisade.
Yeah, so the three-row largest Kia and then the largest Hyundai, all new for 26 and 2027. They've gotten – the Kia's gotten like 2.7 inches longer in wheelbase, 2.3 inches longer overall. It's dumped the V6. It's got a standard turbo 4, or it's got a really good hybrid turbo 4. There's a couple different trims we drove.
Oh, you drove up a river.
Yeah, that was actually pretty cool. Look at that. So this is the off-road trim, which is called the X-Pro. Gives you a little bit more ground clearance, off-road tires, tow points, recovery points front and back, which is very, very cool. Gives you some off-road modes as well. So It's such a good vehicle. I mean, I think for the price point, for
what is the price point?
Starts in the high 30s for the standard turbo four. The hybrid starts in the mid 40s. Realistically, they're transacting like 50s ish, and then they top out right around $60,000. But the luxury you get, massaging seat, heated seats, ventilated seats, the interior is really cool. They just did so much right with this vehicle. I think it's going to be a big seller. There's a we got to kind of address the elephant in the room. There's a very unfortunate incident that happened with the second row power sliding.
Yeah, a baby was killed.
Right, that was really, really sad. So I think there's a stop sale right now, I was reading, on the electric second row.
Yeah, apparently the cutoff didn't work.
And what you really want is the standard sliding second row anyways.
And it's only in the upper trims.
Yeah, right? It is.
The regular trims don't have the power seats.
The standard second row manual slide is so much better anyways than the power slide ones.
So we've got the Palisade here for a long-term review. Thank you, Kia. We're going to have it for a year. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing a lot with it. One of the things that we actually did with it, which is a video that's coming up soon on alltfl.com, is Andre and I compared it to the new Land Cruiser in a towing test. We call it family towers instead of family haulers.
Okay.
And we wanted to see how well the Palisade tows because I think, you know, this is we actually hooked up a side-by-side to it.
Yeah.
I think the Palisade tows up to 5,000 and the Land Cruiser tows up to 6,000. The issue we had with the Palisade is it doesn't have a brake controller, which mm-hmm. is a common issue, we don't have the hybrid. So it does struggle a little bit with 4,500 pounds hooked to the back of it.
Well, the difference between the Palisade and the Telluride is the Palisade you can still get with the normal V6.
Yeah.
So the standard one that we have is a normal V6.
Yeah.
It's a little slow.
You can't get the XRT in the hybrid.
No,
so,
you can't.
So if you want the off-roady one, you got to go with the standard V6.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little slow if you don't get the hybrid version. But and I will say, after spending some time with both, these cars are so – the character is so dependent on the trim specification. So like we had a calligraphy on test, and I think that
– I hate that term, by the way, on test.
Why?
Because it sounds like –
it was
like
on test.
It sounds highfalutin, and it's like, oh, we've got something on test. First of all, is it on test?
Yeah, we tested it.
But is it on – is it sitting on a test? It seems like somebody took like – a British way.
Okay.
The British say that. How about we just had it here for a review?
We had it for test.
You're missing the thing that goes before the test. We had it here for a test.
Well, we had it for test.
No.
It's like, how about that? We had it here for testing.
It's like when the British say, hey, we say, are you okay? Oh, I had to spend some time in the hospital. The British don't say the hospital. They say hospital.
Sure.
And they say the same thing. They say on test or test. So let's not adopt the British way of speaking here. Let's just be American and say, hey, we have it here for a long-term review. And then the other one I hate too.
Sure,
This is something that Kyle does. So Kyle, I blame you for this, my man, from Out of Spec Sports. He does this thing that the Germans do, and he always says on our side, right? Because whenever you go to a German press conference with like the German team, they'll be and from our side, like somehow you're on two different teams, and this is the one side that's presenting something, and you're on the other side. Just say, hey, at BMW, we believe, but you don't have to say, welcome from our side. It's just a very German way. And I grew up partially in Switzerland, so I understand when I hear that in German how it sounds natural in German. But when you say it in English, it just sounds weird. All right, that's my Roman rant for this episode. So no on our side, no on test. We have it here for a review and from our point of view, blah, blah, blah. How about that?
Okay.
Vernacular.
Well, I don't even know what I was going to say now, so I...
Well, it's pretty boring.
I hope your point was very important there, Dad.
My point was that you were getting into the weeds on this thing, and I was getting bored, so I wanted to... Cole says calligraphy.
The high-end writing thing is a big way to say that you've got a luxury car, like calligraphy, autobiography, right? All of these writing terms. I don't know where I was going with that, but... Thank you for lecturing me about the difference between UK.
I'm not lecturing you. I'm just telling you this. I have my set of beliefs, and somehow with the new generation, if you express your belief, then you're lecturing them, right?
Well,
you're no longer allowed with your generation to actually believe anything and then express it in a way because that could potentially trigger you somehow.
I also heard an interesting comedian that says if you're using the term your generation, you're probably not making a good point.
Well, once again, anything that you say that is controversial, you can't say, because that is impolite or can potentially trigger somebody or can potentially create conflict, and that is no longer, except of course when you drop bombs on people. Apparently, that's okay.
All right, you want me to get off your lawn too while we're at it?
Yes, don't take a poop on my lawn.
Okay, so going back to the live chat here. Did Stellantis kill the Wagoneer S? There's no 2026 model. Oh, interesting. Yeah. I haven't heard that. I got to look into that. They did for sure kill the plug-in hybrids, but they also said they were going to continue the Wagoneer.
That's another Jeep that has no off-road ability.
Jonathan says, was going to say Hellcat buyers are not that smart. The fact there are no other Chrysler products other than the Pacifica is crazy. It's kind of sad. The Cherokee could have been a Chrysler. It isn't worthy of the Jeep brand anyways.
How long before the Dolphin becomes the next Chrysler?
The Dolphin?
Mm.
What do you mean Dolphin?
BYD buys Chrysler. You know, you take a $15 billion write-off, that's going to hit your bottom line. And then you've got this Chinese company saying, hey, by the way, you're only selling one vehicle. Why don't you let us? And then all of a sudden, you rename the Dolphin into the Chrysler 200 or 300. And all of a sudden, you've got Chinese cars that are being built, let's call it, in Illinois.
EDM says, did you guys have some off-road trouble with even the Renegade Trailhawk? Yeah, but that one actually did have skid plates and recovery points. So even when we did get stuck, you can still pull it out and you're not worried about tearing something off the bottom. So that one also had a power issue when you're off-road.
It was interesting because in your video on the Cherokee, a lot of people were commenting on the fact that this is an Italian car. Obviously, Stellantis is partially European. But the Renegade, which was based on the Fiat 500L, right?
X
was also an Italian car, and yet it had a lot of off-road cred. We owned it for a number of months.
Yeah, it was.
We took it off-road.
It was okay.
Yeah, it wasn't great, but it was better than this.
Yes, it was better than this, but that was kind of another can of worms, right? That thing was made out of tinfoil, so
it had other issues. Yeah,
quality issues,
transmission specifically.
Yeah. All right, you want to talk about your Land Cruiser?
So we bought the Land Cruiser out of the press fleet. Initially, if you recall, we wanted to buy a Land Cruiser when it first came out. And then by the time we figured it out, the new 4Runner came on. We thought it'd be more interesting to you guys if we pick up a 4Runner. And so I think we were one of the first in the country, thank you Toyota, to be able to buy a 4Runner. We picked it up in California, and we brought it all the way back to... And I got to say, even though they're built on the same chassis, they have the same powertrain. I like the Land Cruiser a lot better, just because I feel like it's much airier. It's got a lot more glass. And I think it's actually... For at least for where I am in my life, a much more comfortable car.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, exactly right. It's a more refined experience, and it's got much better visibility, which is what I've always said. There is the reason I like the Land Cruiser more. It's just easier to see out of. They did an excellent job with this new 250 series, and I know it's a little bit controversial because it's the four-cylinder turbo hybrid and not a V8, but as a whole, it is a really, really, really good product, and I'm really excited to have it on test. For the next year or so.
Hey, it's on test. Actually, uh-huh. It isn't on test. We it's on long term review. We bought it, so it's ours. Cole, can you go to the video that we published this week, because I want to show the biggest change that we did to this, and that is we put on some KO3s. It's on off road, I believe, and we put on some right there. That's the one. We put on some KO3s, and I can't express how big of a change that did to the character of the vehicle.
And you did a great job picking the sizing. It's 10 millimeters wider, so it's also got a little taller.
So we used the same wheels. We got cheap. Our friends at Michelin gave us the tires, so thank you for the KO3. Not Michelin, sorry.
Same company. You're good.
Yeah, Bridgestone.
Yeah, no. Wrong BFG. Company. you were on the right track, and then you went the wrong way.
Of course.
Yeah. So you went a little bit wider and then therefore got a little bit taller. And we'll do a full video with this thing on the next week's podcast. Case and I will take it through the pit and kind of talk about it more in depth. But yeah, I some of the interesting comments. So are you worried at all this may have been the one that Throttle Hells launched off the sand dune?
No.
Are you sure?
I'm not worried about that.
Okay.
Okay. Did they do a Heritage Blue?
Yeah, it's the exact same color.
Was it a 2025?
Car. I don't know. I think it maybe was a 24.
Yeah,
so I think
probably
we're
was
good.
The first year, yeah.
But a lot of comments did say it could be the same car.
I don't think so.
I think it's a different model year.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of risk in buying a used press car.
Yeah, I wasn't too worried about that. I was.
I mean, I don't think that this thing was probably broken in properly.
No, the press fleet managers tend to break them in. They don't let them loose with no miles. They
it depends. Drive Sometimes it's like 200 miles, but if this thing came off the press drive or whatever.
So we bought it after we had it on loan, Tommy,
yes.
from the press fleet twice.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of got a chance to experience it for 2 weeks altogether. And that kind of gave me a sense that this was a relatively good one. It didn't seem like it was very creaky. The one that we had before, which was that weird mustard color gold,
uh-huh.
I think that one was the one that Jason Kanizma used in his video, and that thing was just a pile. It was really loosey-goosey, the one we took to Moab. This one seems much more sorted. It could be because it's another model year.
Yeah.
So maybe Toyota does get better. And Toyota does these ongoing changes. So as you get farther into the product year cycle, they do improve.
You're not worried that this thing has been launched?
I'm not worried
from
about
zero
it.
To 60 on no. every stoplight.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
No, there's other worries I have, but not that. I just think I really like the new Land Cruiser. I think it's one of the best cars that we've bought in the last year. I think Toyota really nailed it. And the question I keep asking myself is, how does Toyota have such a deep, not stockpile, bench of off-roaders? So, and they kind of cannibalize each other to some extent. So you start with the 4Runner. And then if you go up to the TRD Pro in that new Wave Breaker color, you're looking at like a $70,000 vehicle.
Sure, yeah.
And ours was 57. And then, of course, you go to the Land Cruiser, which is now cheaper than the old 200 series. Then you go up to the GX, and then eventually you go up to the LX. That's four incredibly capable and very well-built off-roaders. That is a deep lineup that any manufacturer, I think, would be jealous of. And yet, Jeep, which should have that, is kind of struggling with it. It's a really weird thing what we're going through right now.
Well, I also think that part of the Stellantis issue is they just have so many brands and only so much budget, right? Mm. So you have to spread the budget across 14 brands versus Toyota that's got Toyota and they got Lexus. You know,
I'll give you $80,000. Mm-hmm. Do you buy a 4Runner for, let's say, 57 and then use the rest to go on vacation? Do you buy a Land Cruiser for 75 and then put $5 in the bank? Or do you spend it all on a GX? Which of those three options do you choose?
Driving to the Ineos dealer. Left turn. Getting myself a Grenadier.
You could buy a used one for like $50,000.
Not really.
Yeah, that's what they're at.
I look for them like constantly.
Go look.
I did. The cheapest one I could find was like 61. They hold their value like crazy. Trust me, I have like...
Off-roaders always hold their value, unless they're Range Rovers or Land Rovers, then they don't.
67, 64, 67, 68, 70. I mean, they really, unfortunately...
Those are
used. 10,000 miles, 18,000 miles. They're really hard to find affordable. So they're, to Ineos's credit, I think they've got a lot of issues with that car, but the value holding is not one of them.
I liked our Ineos until I had to go run errands in it, and I could not turn the damn beeping off every time I exceeded the speed limit by 1 mile an hour.
They fixed it though.
Mm.
But now they have a new problem where you have to turn off the lane keep every time.
Yeah, ADF.
So they fixed ADF. The stupid beeping issue, and now you've got the lane keep issue.
Speaking of that, how have we gotten to this point in time where we are now in a place where cars are incredibly and unnecessarily annoying?
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I was so happy when we had our Tesla Model Y with full self-driving, mm-hmm. and I was so impressed by how well it self-drove, and then the subscription ran out, and all of a sudden, every time I get in the car, I got to do three things. Every time you cycle it. So not just in the car, but every time you turn it on and off, you got to turn the lane keep off. You have to turn the – what's the other one?
There's lane keep assist, and then there's emergency lane avoidance, departure avoidance.
So you got to turn both of those off, and then when you turn emergency lane avoidance off, it asks you, are you sure you want to turn this off?
Correct.
So you got to hit three – yeses, to not including getting to that screen. So it's like four every time because it's so intrusive and it's so annoying. And yet there's no law in America that says you have to have that turned on. Right. In Europe, you have to do that. In Europe, there's a law that says...
Which is why the INEOS has it.
Yeah, which is why like the INEOS had that stupid beeping.
Yeah.
And you can't just default to having it off. But in America, you can. And one of the things that made Tesla such an attractive vehicle for me was that the company was not afraid to like do things that customers wanted instead of what the government mandated. But now they're doing something that the government doesn't mandate.
I know.
That's incredibly, it's like the most annoying thing you can do because every time you drive it and you veer just a little bit off of the road, it grabs your steering wheel and throws you back in the lane. It's so annoying. And yet there's no reason to keep it on at every cycle. I don't know why they're doing it. Tesla, can somebody in the comments, or if Tesla, if you're listening, what the F? Why are you doing this? Why? Why are you making your products so unnecessarily annoying?
Did you hear that? I agreed with you.
Yes, finally. Wow. Thank you.
No, I agree. It's tremendously annoying. I need to Google it a little bit to see if there's a way to permanently turn it off. But as far as I can tell, it comes on every time you essentially quote key cycle.
That's the reason you're driving that car, Tommy. I don't want to drive it anymore. And that's the reason.
You have to turn stuff off.
No, and that's the reason.
That's why you sold the Grenadier.
Yeah. Because for me, the Grenadier.
Oh, you can't even sell the Tesla though because it's a lease. Lease.
Yeah.
Well,
it's
oh no!
Yeah, and I think part of the reason it's doing this is because when you have full self-driving, it doesn't make you do this.
Well, because it does it ever all it just drives itself.
So I think that this might be some like stupid ass cunning plan by Musk to force you to spend $99 a month to get FSD because they make the car otherwise so annoying that it becomes undrivable.
And this is the unspoken downside of over-the-air updates. Is like you think of over-the-air updates,
it makes the car worse.
Well, historically in Teslas, like it's made it a lot better, right? You got dog mode, you got camping mode, you got all these new features. The car got better and better, and you're like, wow, I'm just getting this stuff for free. But then they can do stuff like this crap where like, oh, by the way, you can't turn this stuff off or you have to go through three clicks to turn it off, and there's nothing you can do. Dun, dun, dun.
And if somebody from Tesla is listening to this, we have a reservation for that $50,000, $60,000 Cybertruck. You know, the one that because I like the Cybertruck a lot.
Yep.
But I'm going to walk away from that reservation if you don't get rid of this. I will walk away from that reservation.
I don't think Musk is going to mind. I think he can afford it.
So you're going to lose, if you care, you're going to lose one sale and you're going to lose, you know, a relatively prominent YouTube outlet because of this stupid decision to force me to turn off this thing. Three different clicks to turn this thing off. So there you go. Beware. All right. Let's finish with Formula One, Tommy.
Oh, yeah. So my wife has gotten super, super, super into Formula One.
She started watching Drive to Survive, and next thing you know, she's become a big F1 fan.
Which is funny because she cares not at all about cars at all. But then the other day, she was asking me to explain like how an engine works and what a turbocharger does. So it's a hilarious situation I found myself in. She still doesn't care about normal cars, but she really does like Formula One.
Yeah, so Drive to Survive has brought a lot of non-traditional fans into the sport. And I've been a Formula One fan since I was, you know, way...
You haven't watched Formula One in 25 years.
I have, Tommy.
We watched it as a kid when Schumacher was in it.
I've been a fan since I was a little guy. Okay. And I've come and gone out of the sport, as I think many people
sure,
do.
Sure, okay, fair enough. You're right.
I've come and gone out of it.
That's fair.
And the reason I left it last time was because it became a parade. In other words, under the last set of cars, they became very big. They became very.
This was a while ago. This was last season. No, DRS made passing all the time.
They weren't passing all the
time. They were.
No, Tommy. Last season, if you got pole, you won the race. It was in certain tracks, but
That DRS was a game changer for passing. It was really, really interesting.
Anyway, if you got pole, you would win it, and it got boring, especially with Verstappen because he won everything, right? And it was just very predictable, and it became a giant parade instead of a race.
He didn't win the last championship.
And so what they did now was of course they electrified the cars,
which they were before, for the record. But they were hybrids before too.
Right, but they got rid of DRS and they electrified them and they made electricity a bigger part of the game. And the Brits and a lot of people hate this because it's no longer about the best driver going as fast as possible. It's about how you use the technology that's in the car. And I was listening to a podcast, which is the intercooler. And what they did was they defined the difference between overtaking and passing. So overtaking is like you're on the highway and you overtake a truck. There's no drama. It's just moving slower. So, and that's what they define as the kind of racing that you see now. A pass is you have to force the competitor that you're trying to pass to either make a mistake,
sure,
or you break late. It's heroic. It's hard, and it's meaningful. And they're saying what makes current Formula One boring is that people are no longer passing, but they're overtaking, right? You just hit a button, and all of a sudden you use that extra 100 horsepower that you have, and you zip by somebody on a straightaway, and that makes it boring to them because it's not heroic, it's not challenging. And I understand that. I get that. But, dude, there was something like 150 overtakes or passes in the very first one in Melbourne. And it was exciting. It was actually fun to see cars actually vying for position. And yes, maybe it wasn't passing, but it was interesting because things were happening. It wasn't just this giant parade of cars going way too fast or very fast,
right,
with nobody able to pass anybody else, and the person who won the grid position being the one that eventually wins the race.
Yeah,
and so I think it shook it up, and it made it interesting to me. And so I'm kind of back into it. And yes, maybe I'm not a purist, and maybe I haven't been, you know, washed in the wool, like, you know, going back to the bare-chested days when guys would put their lives at risk. And I understand that, but it's more entertaining than it was. And I like new technology, and times move on. And yes, I understand the feeling that everybody wants V12s back, and this new technology is making it slower, more boring, more, I don't know, overtaking friendly, but for me it works.
Jonathan was saying he's been watching for 12 years in the live chat and he likes it too. Yeah, I mean, I still think that, like, the whole discussion about, like, why are we hybridizing a race car is kind of valid. You know, I do miss the sound and the kind of the drama of the V10s and the V8s, right? Those were really interesting. But to your point, before DRS, I think that it was DRS is drag reduction system, and basically, as I understand it, if you're within 1 second of the person in front of you on certain sections of the track, you can engage a mode where it'll actually change the aero of the car to make it faster so you could pass.
Yeah, so you change the spoiler from like this to like that.
And then that was killed for this year,
yeah.
And now they've gone to a passing button, which gives you a burst of electricity, which essentially acts exactly the same as DRS. It's just instead of adding an aero advantage, it gives you a power advantage.
And it's a significant power
advantage. It's a little bit Mario
Kart.
It's like
100 horsepower.
Yeah, it's a little bit Mario Kart, but I also think that it makes for interesting racing. Yeah, and I watched Australia, and then we watched China, and we watched the whole race, and it was very entertaining. So the big challenge this year, the reason that people are grumpy, is it's 50% engine propulsion and 50% battery propulsion. That was the big change for this year over past years. They made the electricity a bigger component. But what that means is that you really have to manage the energy leaving and entering the battery when you regen and then spend the power. So you want to – it adds a new layer of the drivers have to make sure that as they're going down the track, they're saving battery for the straights, and then they can deploy it on the straights. So it's a little gimmicky, but it also adds another layer of complexity, which I think makes the fundamental racing a little bit more exciting, and I think that's cool.
Yeah, anyway, so the solution that died in the wool – petrolheads, which is what they're called in Britain. And let's face it, Britain is the home of Formula One. All the teams.
Yeah, they're all based.
So I'm not being. It is. They're all based in one part of Britain. Their solution is sustainable fuels. The problem with sustainable fuels is, first of all, I think I heard that it's $400 a gallon.
Yes.
In Formula One to have a sustainable fuel. So that's not going to sell at the local gas pump. But the problem with them is that Porsche tried to pioneer this, and I give Porsche a lot of credit. So they opened up a sustainable fuel refinery in Chile, of all places.
Right.
And the idea is that you take carbon out of the air. So one of the issues with, of course, burning fossil fuels is that you create a lot of carbon, which then adds to global warming. And I'm going to call it warming. Let's be real. It's been 95 degrees here in Denver in the middle of winter, so things are getting hotter. I get climate change is a nice way to tone that down.
Keep going.
No, it's important, Tommy, because somehow facts and science has become irrelevant in today's discussion, so I'm going to bring it back. Anyway, so they created this refinery in Chile where you take carbon out of the air and then you transform that carbon using energy, electricity, into a liquid state, which is a fuel, which then you can use to power a car, which then turns back into carbon. So the idea is it's carbon neutral. So you're taking carbon out of the air and then you're putting it back when you burn the fuel. Except for when they actually tried it, they didn't have the carbon scrubbers available yet. So they actually had to buy carbon. So they didn't take any carbon out of the air. They had to buy it. And then it takes energy to create the fuel. And then, of course, since this is in Chile, you got to use energy to truck it to the port. Then you got to use bunker fuel, which is horrible, to truck it to Europe. And then you got to use energy and petroleum to truck it to the gas station. And at the rate we're going, this carbon neutral fuel becomes incredibly non-carbon neutral and incredibly expensive. So yes, if you can make carbon neutral fuel actually work in reality, then go for it. But isn't it just easier to take whatever form of energy you want, which is could be solar or wind or even natural gas or even coal, and just burn it and create electricity and then plug it into your car, which is a much simpler way than going through this entire process just so you can maintain the, let's say, the veneer of carbon neutrality.
Well, they have that. It's called Formula E, and it's really boring. But
true that.
The bigger, I think you're missing the bigger point.
Okay, what's the bigger point?
Right? We're so focused on making these race cars better for the environment. Mm-hmm. And then the second the race is over.
Yeah, they fly everybody on
the car is loaded into a truck. And then the truck is shipped on a plane to the next city. Yeah. Right? And then the drivers get on a private jet and fly to the next city.
Well, some will take commercial.
So, yeah. But first class commercial. So here's what you end up with a situation where, like, okay, so maybe that 80 kilograms of fuel you're burning in the car is a little bit better for the planet, but then what about the 3,000 kilograms of fuel it takes to get the team from place to place?
Yeah, so, I think that petrol heads would make that point, so why not just burn
well exactly burn it, race that's fuel. Stupid. The whole thing is kind of silly,
but they're talking about this as a solution, not electrification. This, they're talking about this, do this instead of electrifying cars, just use carbon neutral fuels.
Like in normal cars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the point. But they still haven't figured out all the rest of it.
But I think fundamentally, Dad, electric cars are just not as fun as gas.
No, I am there, dude. I think electric cars
are toasters. For the environment, yeah, it's a lot better just to make solar power. But from an experience, like, car guys are going to be car guys, right? They want to burn stuff and they want to make cool noises. So... Right. That's the reality of the situation.
Look, I am there, Tommy. I love Hellcats. We've owned a bunch of them. I love burning, you know, old dinosaurs and creating smoke and creating explosions out of it. But I just don't like it when cars and this becomes political. Give people a choice and you don't have to subsidize it. Don't subsidize electric cars and don't subsidize carbon neutral fuels and don't subsidize automakers. Just let people choose what form of propulsion they want and let the market decide. But nobody seems to want to do that anymore.
I'm
very much free market. Let the market decide. You know, right now we're living the previous administration was very pro renewables and spent a lot of money and time trying to get people and trying to force people to do it. And the exact opposite happened, right? There was this huge pendulum swing that went the other way. And now this administration is doing the exact same thing, but in the other way. They're killing renewable projects. You know, they're making it hard to buy electric cars. They're not allowing importation of electric cars, yada, yada, yada. Just let the free market decide. Let people buy what they want to buy.
All right, guys. Well, let us know what you think in the comment section below. We're going to end it here.
Yeah.
And we'll see you in the next podcast.
Not too much bickering.
There's a lot of bickering.
Yeah, sorry. Ciao.